Everyone, welcome to the November 30th edition of the In The Now Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with...
Meme in the Machine.
And we'll be coming at you with another good show this month. Lots of information to talk about. Sit back and enjoy the ride. That's a DJ Meme on the In The Now Show this evening, and we'll be hearing a lot of her DJ skills in the background as we proceed with the news for the last 2 weeks. All right. Well, how you been doing, Meme? How was your holiday?
Oh, relatively decent. Haven't had any food poisoning or acts of terrorism, so relatively decent.
Awesome. Okay. Well... we have lots of information. We're going to get right to it. Well, the RIAA is attacking people as usual. And Megan Dickinson, in the middle of a controversy, she's a 15-year-old girl that didn't know that downloading music was a bad thing. So she had downloaded actually 1,100 songs somewhere in that area. And the RIAA is attacking her and her family, saying that... she is infringing on copyright. Well, little Megan had no idea that downloading the songs was illegal. So they are ordering her, well, the RIAA is ordering her family to either settle out of court for $3,500 or pay $750 per song, which ends up being $825,000. Well, it sounds like... Becca Dickinson, which is her mother, sounds like their family isn't, you know, they're struggling along with most of the other people in America these days, trying to pay their bills and keep up to date and work hard and all this, and now they have to dish out right around the holidays around $3,500.
Well, I'm sure they planned it that way.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Does the music industry really have something to gain by squeezing $3,500 out of Megan Dickinson and her family?
Yeah, I think it's called deterrence through terror.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be terrorism?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's terrorism.
Paper terrorism.
Yeah. You know, it's really easy to get shot in the head because it's really painless. But when somebody, you know, starts trying to take your living away from you, $3,500 isn't taking your entire life away from you. But it's certainly, you know, it really can be annoying if you don't have $3,500 to spare.
Well, it's a good exercise in disproportionalism because I think what it costs for them to expedite this claim probably exceeded, you know,
yeah.
What they collected. I don't see the point.
Yeah. Well,
to scare people and intimidate people.
Yeah, that's the real point. But, I don't know. We're going to be talking about more intimidation later by our buddies at SCO. All right. Well, we've talked about this in the past, and I think a lot of people heard about DVD John, which is John, what's his last name? Johansson from Norway. He's the one that actually wrote DECSS to allow people to play DVDs on their Linux system. Well, he has now come up with a new tool that unlocks iTunes music. John Lech Johansson, better known as DVD John for his authorship of the DECSS decryption software, has turned his attention to Apple's locked music format. While he hasn't decrypted the DRM that Apple uses, he has produced a simple Windows command line utility which will install a DLL that dumps the output of a QuickTime stream to a file. The short C program is called QuickTime for Windows AAC Memory Dump Dumper. And let's see, there's another application called MyTunes, which already performs much of the same function, but Johansson's is open source. So basically, he unveils the DLL entry point and the exit hole. So let the this is part of the article. Let the fun and games begin. Going along that. So, he's definitely making more news, coming out with more tools, and it's basically just making things free.
More is better. More choices.
So, that's something to look for, and if you're using iTunes, check it out. There's no website, but I'm sure you could Google the program, which... Yeah, QuickTime for Windows AAC Memory Dumper. So, definitely check that out. I mean, as you can see, it's going to be a more growing concern with, I don't know if something can be more growing, but it's definitely a growing concern with people that are, you know, getting involved with buying music, and people are putting their own formats and digital rights management and other evil baddies in there. Obviously... You know, it is making things a little bit easier for people to get music, you know, without having to pay for a full album. And it's actually quite cheap for iTunes. It's about $1 a song, I think.
Yeah, a lot of times it varies with the copyright holders, too. And I think the biggest problem is they're still not getting the message that people want flexibility, you know, with their media. And a lot of times these applications are just too centric in terms of how they want to handle files. And people want complete flexibility and openness and transparency in how they handle their media.
Yeah. So I do believe that, you know, that there are people out there that can abuse things like, you know, file sharing and such like that. But it also has its benefits. And there are people out there, I think, that are doing healthy file sharing. And I can see why some of these technologies come about. It's actually helping the consumer that there's things like iTunes and the other services that are being offered out there for music download. But it also is helpful to be able to have a tool against the machine to be able to circumvent any of those baddies that may come your way. So it's the ever struggle with... it's always an ever struggle with many things. And this is one of the things that it'll be a struggle with for a very long time. All right. Well, there was a new worm out, and it's called the Notchy worm, and basically it infected Diebold ATMs. So another interesting worm that basically attacks the DCOM exploit that has been in most Windows machines, and it does a few things. The Nachi worm compromised Windows-based automated teller machines at two financial institutions last August, according to the ATM maker Diebold, in the first confirmed case of malicious code penetrating cash machines. The machines were an advanced line of Diebold ATMs built atop a Windows XP embedded, which, like most versions of Windows, was vulnerable to the RPC DCOM security bug exploited by Nachi, which is the worm. At both affected institutions, the ATMs began aggressively scanning for other vulnerable networks, generating anomalous waves of network traffic that tripped the bank's intrusion detection systems, resulting in the infected machines being automatically cut off. The outbound traffic from the ATMs was stopped, limited from a network standpoint, and effectively isolated. In many cases, the machines were cleaned up that day. A patch for the critical RPC DCOM hole had been available from Microsoft for over a month at the time of the attack, but Diebold had neglected to install it in the infected machines. Billette, which is one of the employers of the company, defended the company's patching process, which he said involves testing each new bug fix and deploying at a wide variety of institutions with a mix of network architectures. A lot of those machines actually have to be visited by a service technician to be patched, said Billette. Our experience in this past is we are able to turn those around in a day or two. And as many know, because we talked about it before, in January, Slammer's Worm basically indirectly shut down some 13,000 Bank of American ATMs by infecting database servers on the same network and spewing out so much traffic that the cash machines couldn't process customers' transactions.
And this is the same company who's going to be making secured voting machines.
Is it?
They're one of the players, yes.
Oh, you know, I was reading about that.
They do secured transactions, yeah.
You know, they said the one thing to do, the fix of it, they said they're shipping all new Windows-based ATMs pre-installed with software-based firewall made by Syscape Technologies. You know, basically they're going to put a big old wall in front of those Windows machines and try to keep things back. So, not just the home users and... Well, everyone has been affected by these exploits, but now it's not now. I mean, it's been showing, and this is another example of showing how things are getting into critical infrastructure and causing damage and problems, and it's something that needs to be addressed. Now, this is my thought: do you really need the Windows operating system? Because it's, I mean, there's a lot more to it than. It's got so much more functionality than you really need for an ATM.
Well, I think the bigger question is, obviously, we talk a whole lot about open source and the need for solutions that are alternatives. But in the case of things that are mission-critical apps, such as an ATM, that's a good case to be made for something that's proprietary, or at least not something as general purpose as Windows, which... In my opinion, it's just ridiculous because there's too many loose ends there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I know Microsoft's pushed, you know, to make it available everywhere, and they're trying to get it everywhere. Like, there's actually a free open source operating. Well, it's not free, but it's open source. I believe, yeah, it's open source. The Tron operating system, which has been deployed on like tons of devices, like this, automobile, stuff like that. You know, because you need something that's you need an operating system that can run on small architecture and do things, but embedded Windows XP, I'm sure they cut out some of the functionality of it, but it really has, I mean, you know, why does it need DCOM? Why do you need RPC on an ATM? You know, there's no, I can't think of any reason to have that on an ATM. You know, it has to have a little GUI and basically needs to send a transaction back TCP/IP and other stuff like that, and you know, if they're going to use secure certificates or however their method of transaction, but you know, all these other things do not need to be enabled. It's just a you know, overkill of application for the software application, for the real application, its real use. It's just
it's an object lesson in how not to use appropriate technology.
Yeah. So, you know, being a Linux advocate, I guess I could say, you know, I don't want to sound redundant, but, you know, you could use a totally stripped down Linux to do it. But you could also, I believe, and I'm not really an expert in that field of knowing the types of embedded technologies that are out there, but I know that there is a lot of other options because there are people developing things for that. So
it's such a mature medium. You would think by now there would be a, you know, a ground up solution for this, and there's really not. It's a lot of legacy piggybacking still going on.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know, but
I can remember even just a few years ago when I would go into a convenience store, seeing a lot of off the shelf hardware, you know, set up, you know, like Doctel systems and AT&T and stuff like that on the back of these ATM machines, and not even having, you know, case mods or anything to secure the stuff. It's just, it's frightening.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of vendors out there, you know, are selling things, and you don't know exactly what you're buying unless you have somebody, hopefully, that's employed with your organization that's you know, like a geek or knows the ins and outs or knows the correct questions to ask about systems like that. And
but they're just putting another GUI on it. You know, you can go to an ATM, and it's, as far as you're concerned, it's going to be a kiosk experience. But in reality, it's usually based on something that's, you know, totally inappropriate, usually.
Yeah, I've seen ATMs. It looks like a Commodore 64 is running it. You know, you just see some pretty generic text, and you hit enter or whatever buttons on the side, and off you go. You know, if they want to put like advertisements and colors and pictures and all that crap, then you know, maybe they need a GUI. But
that's when I got a little suspicious, though, was when I started seeing these color ATM machines with advertisements and stuff on them. I started thinking, well, wait a minute, these things are starting to look a little too normal. Maybe they're building it, you know.
Yeah, you're like, wow, this is a really functional cash dispenser, you know.
you're realizing they're using the same thing as your neighbor.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting story as well, kind of a weird story. In Toronto, a half-naked man found driving in the city street was arrested and charged with child porn offenses this week, which the article was in November. In the first Canadian case involving wireless internet signal piracy, the bizarre case began when a Toronto police officer spotted a motorist going the wrong way down a one-way street in a residential neighborhood. After pulling the man over, Sergeant Don Woods discovered the man was naked from the waist down, and he has downloaded images on his laptop computer of a young girl involved in a sexual act with an adult. I'm just going to pause right there and ask, did he have the laptop open with the naked pictures, or is this one technical savvy cop? You know,
he must have searched the car.
Yeah, he said, show me what's in your My Documents. I don't know.
he was suspicious when he saw the fog inside the cockpit, probably. You know,
yeah. Yeah, and the baby oil on the seat. Anyways.
I hope that was baby oil.
Yeah, or cocoa butter. Anyway, investigation showed the man had hooked into a wireless computer network at the nearby house to gain access to a resident's internet connection and download images of child pornography websites. The scheme known as war driving. Yeah, see, that's what war driving is. I'm going to repeat that again. What war driving is...
You say whore driving or war driving?
It's war driving. It's hooking into a wireless computer network at a nearby house to gain access to a resident's internet connection and download images of child pornography websites. Or download images from. So that's what war driving is, if nobody know out there. It's all about getting child porn off your neighbor's internet connection. Allows a computer... War driving allows a computer... Oh, okay, well... I'm sorry, I just misread the article, but it kind of makes you feel this way, okay? The sentence is different. It's actually, the scheme known as war driving allows a computer with wireless internet capability to tap into wireless home networks and access the World Wide Web, usually without fear of discovery. Well, that's incorrect, too. It's, I don't know if anybody really, like, is so scared to surf the internet at their house, they're going to go surf at their buddy's house, you know. And actually, war driving isn't really about tapping into a network. It's kind of like finding the networks is actually the war driving.
Well, it's surveying. It's like mapping.
Yeah, it's a tool like, you know, like war dialing. War dialing, you didn't get into the networks from war dialing. It was a tool to find phone numbers that were connected to modems or you know, backdoors to well, as modems generally, into, you know, the back ends of computer systems that people would dial up into and do whatever they wanted. But
it's like bird watching for geeks.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But I guess what it is now is to surf the internet because of fear of discovery. So you guys have figured me out. I'm on my network, my neighbor's network, and I shop at Sears online. I'm afraid to tell everyone about it, but I guess I'm going to come clean now since it's the right thing to do.
I guess if you're paranoid, you can just go down to the, you know, pawn shop, get a generic laptop, and you know, go to a Starbucks or something.
Yeah. And shop at Sears there. We have never laid a war driving related charge before, says Sergeant Paul Gillespie. And Gillespie said the Texas the detectives from the child exploration section made arrangements with the OPP to search the suspect's home in southwestern Ontario. They seized 10 computers and hundreds of CDs and floppy disks, he said. Right now, I would say I'm looking at hundreds of thousands of images. He's actually looking at every one to make sure it's what it is, yeah. Gillespie said that it will take 20 to 40 hours to forensically examine each computer, but so far investigators have been exposed to some of the worst child pornography they've ever seen. I mean, I'm glad in a sense that they caught this guy. I mean,
yeah,
I'm happy about that.
He sounds pretty prodigious.
He says right down to very young children and babies. Ugh. Walter Nowoski, 36, of Delphi, is charged with possession of child pornography, accessing child pornography, distributing child pornography, making child pornography, and theft of telecommunications.
He's a turnkey porn king.
Yeah. He's being held in custody and scheduled for a bail hearing. Well, I'm glad they caught him. I mean, it really sucks to have your home network used for that purpose. You know what I mean? I mean, you're inadvertently, you know, not trying to, but, could be contributing to somebody else's bad habits. And you could, sometimes...
That's the downside to sharing, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing, too, is that a lot of people aren't securing their wireless networks properly, which is I'm not a fan of wireless networks as far as... having, if you're going to use it and there's going to be traffic over it, like your home network connections to your computers, surfing the internet. If it's a company that says, like, look, you know, we're doing Wi-Fi at Starbucks, or we're doing it in this park, or we're doing it at the airport, and you want to get on the internet, you can surf whatever the heck you want. It's going to be your fault. It's not going to be ours for providing that service. You're going to be misusing it. But, you know, that's something to worry about, and I think we've talked about it before, is that if you have a Wi-Fi network at your house, you know, use some form of encryption on it. Use WEP. Do what you can. You know, use all the security features that are on the wireless access points. You know, talk to one of the reps at the stores. Hopefully they know about the different access points and their features and see what they recommend. But definitely don't be lazy. You know, use those features and, maybe learn something in the process, which is one of the benefits. And the other benefit is to keep people off your network unless you want to offer that service. But, you know, be careful about, you don't want somebody using your machine, like somebody using your, like hacking your machine, breaking into it or whatever, using your machine for criminal intent. That's another thing that you can get yourself busted, and you may have not done anything wrong in the first place. So
yeah, test your network. You should even try to get in yourself.
Yeah, and you're just going to have a lot of fun trying to do it anyways, and learning that kind of stuff, so. Okay. Well, another way to misuse technology, and this is from our buddy Aaron Greenspan here. At Harvard University, junior president of consulting company Think Computer published a white paper Thursday, which is earlier this November, detailing a problem discovered when a client server was found to be sending spam. Greenspan's research concluded that Exchange 5.5 in 2000 can be used by spammers to send anonymous email. He says even though the software Microsoft says or provides on its site certifies that the server is secure, it's not. If the guest account is enabled on Exchange 5.5 in 2000, even if your login fails, you can send mail because the guest account is there as a catch-all. So people have been using that as a tool to basically turn your mail server into an open relay server, which means
it's a feature.
Anybody can openly relay messages through your server. That includes people that do spam and anybody else that feels like doing it. Okay. Moving right along. So many things to cover, so many things to talk about. I hope the audience, is definitely getting each section of the story as we move on. Well, early this November, AT&T filed a suit against eBay and PayPal alleging patent infringement, the latest skirmish in escalating web patent wars. The suit, filed in a federal district court in Delaware, claims that eBay and PayPal's online payment systems infringe on AT&T patent number 5,329,589, mediation of transactions by a communications system. That patent, according to an AT&T release announced, the suit describes transactions in which a trusted intermediary securely process payments over a communication system such as the Internet. The use of a trusted intermediary ensures that the party will not have to disclose sensitive information such as a credit card number or bank account number or the other party to the transaction. Well, shoot, I mean, you could sue everybody, saying that they're infringing on that. eBay said, I discussed the patent with AT&T in the past, but believed that the suit was without merit and planned to defend itself vigorously.
Well, this reminds me of the famous Bill Gates quote to Steve Jobs when he says, well, gosh, Steve, if you built a car with a steering wheel in it, does that mean I can't build a car with a steering wheel in it?
Yeah. Huh? I mean, that's... Oh, man.
I mean, this is the same nonsense that reared its ugly head in the early 90s when they said, we're going to have a different billing rate if you transmit facsimiles or do data transfer over a regular residential voice line, which they actually tried to do.
I mean, there's just some things that are just going to be out there, tools and ways of doing things like, if you go create your own bow and arrow, is somebody going to come after you saying, my great-great-great-great-great-great-whatever-super-great-grandfather created the bow and arrow, and you're using the same design? I mean, some of those things are just so ridiculous. They're just tools that are there.
They're universal concepts.
It's a universal... I mean, obviously, this is a new concept because of this technology is new to age, but it's sent a tier. It's a common concept. I mean, give me a break. I mean, that's just... It's easy to figure that out, hey, I want to send money back and forth. Well, how can I do that, with more security? Well, let's offer a service that there's a third party. How many people, do that? How many times is the third party just the code in the website transactioning it in a way to where you're not seeing something you shouldn't, and the information's handled in a proper, means?
Well, I have a remedy, though, and that's the countermeasure, and that is that AT&T... can have a claim against them because Bell did not invent the original telephone.
What do you mean as far as, a claim against who?
Well, maybe the French should try to sue AT&T.
Oh, because you're saying, okay.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to split hairs, let's go all the way back.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the many hair-splitting things going on with... companies, obviously we talked about the SCO, Linux, everything debacle that happens and is still happening, and we'll definitely get more into that. But you're just finding out what it's all about, and it's all about the bling bling. Bill Gates and the bling bling.
Well, it's keeping lawyers employed too.
Yeah. And they'll do things to help keep themselves employed, that's for sure. Even if it's outside of the original problem, they'll do little extra, we need to do this, or we're going to sue all these extra people, or we need to involve these other lawyers, or it's just keeping themselves busy.
Yeah, who says they're not creative though?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's I don't know if they have I don't know what kind of classes they're teaching. It seems like once you get done with going through law school, you learn the idea of what it's supposed to be about. And then when they get out, it seems like there's some sort of hidden classes, or maybe there's this hidden institute, or, you know, they have these little pamphlets they hand out, like, look, buddy, you're going to join our firm. Cool, this is, like, the things you need to know that school never taught you. You know, so, that hurts.
I know, I didn't mean to.
But, yeah, so there's a...
That's my Geiger counter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're making sure that everything's going on smoothly here. Okay, well, moving on from that. Well, some people have been complaining that when they call Dell Tech Support for their OptiPlex desktop or Latitude notebook, they can't understand the guy from India who's trying to help them. So, computer technical support center in India is now no longer going to be handling calls from its corporate customers, but it will be handling calls from some home PC users.
I don't know why that's so funny. It is.
Yeah, it's all right. You know, we're not going to let the our corporate customers, because they buy in bulk. But, you know, it's okay if you're at home and you have a problem with your Dell.
If you don't spend as much money, we're going to make you pay your dues.
Yeah, and it's okay if they don't speak English, or if they talk. I'm not downing anybody from India. I'm just saying. It's hard. If you're from India and you don't understand English or accent or something, you know, it's vice versa. It's just not fun, you know. So
Dell's telling you, if you don't spend a certain price point, you're going to get, you know,
you're not going to get the quality customer care, which they've touted themselves as being, you know, having the quality customer care.
They're dropping you a hint, you know, read your manual.
Yeah. All right. Actually, this is the one I meant to say, our buddy, John Ashcroft. Okay. Attorney General John Ashcroft said Thursday, which is earlier in November, that law enforcement agents had arrested 125 suspects in a crackdown on internet crimes ranging from hacking and software piracy to credit card fraud and selling stolen goods over the internet. The investigation began October 1st and dubbed Operation Cyber Sweep, involving police from Guyana to Southern California, and uncovered 125,000 victims who had lost more than $100 million. He told a news conference, 70 indictments to date have led to arrest or convictions of 125 people, with more expected as the probe continues. Information superhighway would be a conduit for communication, information, and commerce, not an expressway for crime, Ashcroft said. Those arrested stand charged with a variety of crimes that highlight the innumerable scams and criminal acts that now take place online. The online criminals assume that they can protect or conduct their schemes with impunity, Ashcroft said. Operation Cyber Sweep is proving them wrong. Operation Cyber Sweep. By piercing the criminals' cloaking with anonymity and prosecuting them to the fullest extent of the law. There's nothing wrong with going after the criminals. I just, Operation Cyber Sweep just kind of sounds a little dorky.
Yeah, I think this whole thing's more about scoring PR points, because, I mean, 125 is not really that impressive. I mean,
yeah, there's probably 125 people here in Arizona that do cyber crimes. But hey, I mean, it's good that they're doing it. I'm glad that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, you can use crime anywhere, and you know, this is just a new area.
But it's kind of a spinoff of that Operation Pipe Dreams, you know, when they redirected all those domain names that were related to drug paraphernalia. Remember that? They put Tommy Chong in prison, even.
Oh, I don't know about that. What happened?
Oh, yeah. The guy that you know, used to be in Cheech and Chong was running a website selling glass pipes, and apparently it's illegal to sell pipes over the internet. And Ashcroft, I think there was around 13 domains that were redirected and seized and whatnot.
Huh.
But they were redirecting all the traffic to the FBI or DEA website, I remember.
I guess my question is, there is really a law you can't sell bongs over the internet?
Yep. There sure is.
Really? There's got to be lots of places that sell that stuff.
Under the internet, I think it was the Telecommunications Decency Act, any type of content that is related to illegal activity, anything from, like, you know, using drugs to overthrowing the government, if it's depicted online, is a violation of the crime now.
What?
Yeah.
What? That's
insane. They just weren't enforcing it.
What the heck?
Yeah, it was called Internet. I think it was the Telecommunications Decency Act.
I'm sure there's got to be some sort of decency, but it's like taking away. Like, if you want to sell a bong in the United States, you can sell a bong. So why can't you do it on the internet? That's pretty stupid.
Well, the state. I think what it is that laws vary from state to state.
Yeah,
so
they
one
do.
Individual state. Can basically bring, I don't know, a criminal charge, but I know they bring civil charges at least.
Huh. Hmm. That's
like
strange.
There was a kid who asphyxiated himself with a balloon and sued somebody for selling them whippets, across state lines one time. I heard about that. They bought it on the internet and the guy got arrested, and he's from Arizona.
Hmm. The cases range from a Virginia woman who sent fake emails to America Online customers asking them to update their credit card numbers to a disgruntled Philadelphia Phillies fan who hacked the computers nationwide and launched spam emails criticizing the baseball team. Many are accused of selling stolen or non-existent goods online, a leading cybercrime category. Suspects fenced stolen goods through an online auction sites like eBay, set up phony escrow services to handle payments, and touted fraudulent investment clubs through slick websites, according to a summary of the cases provided by the Department of Justice. Suspects also stole classified files from government computers, hacked into business computers to steal customers' credit card numbers, disabled computers running child abuse hotlines. Disabled computers running child abuse hotlines?
Well, he was a real renaissance man, wasn't he?
Man, I can't wait to see his site, the packed page he put up or something. Saying, you have been owned by the Pornography Abuse Alliance.
It's probably one that's multiple personalities. That's what it is.
Jeez.
Would he keep up with all the PIN numbers?
Gosh. And sold counterfeit software or computer memory chips. Said one California man continued to send online death threats to a Canadian who he thought was sending him spam email, even after authorities asked him to stop. U.S. Secret Service agents worked through foreign laws. Law enforcers to track down suspects who operate across international borders, spreading to the rest of a Romanian man who said bilked some $500,000 from online auction participants. I know a lot of people that cause problems in Romania, let me tell you. Just get on internet and you'll find out. Authorities in Guyana and Nigeria also helped track down suspects to recover millions of dollars in ill-gotten gains. The crackdown stemmed from indications that internet fraud continues to rise. The Internet Fraud Complaint Center, run in part by the FBI, referred some 58,000 complaints to law enforcement in the first 9 months of 2003, compared with 48,000 for all 2002. Well, definitely a lot of bad things doing on the internet. Kind of like the real world. It's its own virtual entity.
Yeah, it's becoming quite a microcosm. It's like it takes a certain number of years for things to reach a critical mass of saturation where you get the whole, Jerry Springer strata to, join in on it as well.
Yeah. Well, I just say that, just use common sense with, I'm not saying when you're something to say to the criminals, something to say to somebody that just wants to use the internet as a useful service. Just have common sense with what you're doing online.
Well, or even with childhood pranks. Like, I've heard of people bidding on things on eBay and then, not having the money and screwing up people's auctions and stuff like that. Just stupid stuff.
Yeah. You're always taking a risk. They do have third-party people that do things for eBay. Like, if you buy something or you want to buy something, there'll be a service that will check out the item, see if it's indicated, if the description is correct, tell you if there's any other damages or problems with it, and then you can, send money to them and get that. It costs a little fee, but
on those critical big ticket items, that's
you can
make it or break it.
Have a little bit more confidence in what you're doing. So they have things like that are covering that. But if you see some weird things happening, question if anybody asks you for any information. Ask them why. Think in your head, why do they need this information? And
or how did they get the merchandise? Like, did they steal it?
Yeah. Well, you know, you never help yourself. If it's stolen, you don't really know.
I mean, if you see an electron scanning microscope at $4,500, good chance, particularly if it's coming out of a university location, that they probably don't own it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's going to go to someone, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You might as well get it. But, you know, it's just and especially if there's a system in place like eBay or something like that, or if there's somebody trying to, like, ask you to go down these other paths or roads that don't seem like it's a part of the normal system that you're, you know, dealing with, the website or processing system or anything like that, or, you know, go ahead and call the company themselves. If it sounds a little fishy, and say, hey, I got this thing going on. Yeah, well, I mean, a call, like, if it's like eBay, you know, you can send them email. Or if it's like AOL and somebody's asking for your credit card, if you don't know, like, is this really something going on here? Do they, you know, if you just don't generally know, and it sounds a little fishy, you can, you know, look things up. Or you could just tell the guy, look, I don't want to send it, and see what they say in reaction.
Well, I'm noticing that you're now having a element, you know, come into the medium that wasn't there a few years ago just because of the prohibitive learning curve getting online. But with all these net appliances and easy-to-gain accounts, you have a criminal element getting on there doing really, for lack of a better way of saying it, a very halfway way of doing things, you know, doing really stupid things, you know, where you know they're going to get caught, like spamming, you know, from a regular dial-up account or something like that.
Yeah, there's definitely easy ways to get on, and it's really hard to track. I mean, you don't see makers of NIMDA and all these things being taken down, you know, or it's a wild place out there on the internet. All right. Well, we've talked about this before, but there are new technologies coming out to bring you the internet experience. Hydro-Québec is to test the internet over power lines, I think, this January. So they didn't mention anything. We've talked about this happening in other countries, a few other countries out there that are doing it. But, yeah, they're going to be yet another person trying to see how well internet can be over the power lines. It doesn't say exactly what the speed will be. It said it could be up to 5 times faster than high-speed cable. So that's pretty quick.
Yeah, so Hydro-Québec will do high-speed internet over power lines, and Enron just robs people of their retirements.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, why don't we have anything that innovative, you know, coming out of our, you know, big utility companies?
Well, I don't know. I mean, why are we behind? No, not too far. Well, I don't know if we're too far behind. But, I mean, we're behind in the cell phone arena compared to Europe and other countries.
Yeah. Like when I was in Europe about 3-4 years ago, you could use your cell phone to buy a soda.
Really?
At a vending machine, yeah. I mean,
Really? Yeah. Huh.
They had a lot of purchases that would be billed through cell phone accounts. And I came back to the States and people thought I was hallucinating when I told them that.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, it says it hopes to offer the service in a few years. So it's still in the testing phases, but they've found it is plausible. They can make it happen. And they just need to develop the infrastructure to make it happen. Korea is to build a 100 megabit internet system. And basically the infrastructure will be called the Broadband Convergence Network, the BCN. The construction of it will be worth $95 trillion in their money. So in our money, it's actually $80.4 billion, which is quite a bit of money. An output of equipment and services, and we'll be creating 370,000 jobs by 2010. So they're actually regarded as one of the world's leading broadband nation, with most of their people already on broadband. So 11.3 million people.
And what I want to know is how in North Korea you've got the dictator Kim Jong-il, who's trying to put together some formidable army of super hacker, you know, elites, and like, I don't even think they have dial-up down there, do they?
Well, in North, I don't really know.
I mean, they got all this broadband in South Korea. I'm just trying to figure out how the North is going to be such a threat when they don't even have broadband.
I don't know. You know, the thing is that the RIAA is really going to have a problem if people start getting 100 megabit into their house. You know, that's what do you do after that? Or you can transfer full movies in no time, you know, and And that kind of ban was crazy. I mean, shoot. I mean, how are people going to, how are hosting companies going to charge anymore when your own, maybe the upload is nothing, you know, but the download is a lot, you know. That's probably how they'll limit it. You know, there's all that commerce out there of people with high bandwidth and selling it. You're going to have 100 megabit to your house. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think it's kind of a pipe dream, you know, that that's going to happen in the near future.
Well, I think the MPAA has got more to worry about.
Yeah.
Because I think everything's reached a critical mass with, you know, MP3, you know, for audio. But these richer, you know, formats that are just much more intensive really haven't reached a critical mass of, you know, sharing and exchange until, you know, people have bigger pipes.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't see that happening soon. But and if it did, it's going to be, they're going to limit the upload for sure. Because you're going to be charging people to run websites off your, you know, fast
service. I mean,
you
already have universities, you know, restricting, you know, activity.
Yeah. Well, getting more towards the Linux area, GNU Linux area of our show. Basically, a few Debian Project machines were broken into. Interesting thing is, they don't know how they got root access. Their machines, the following machines have been affected. The master machine, that's the name, master. It's a bug tracking system. Murphy, mailing list Gluck, which is web and CVS. And Kletcher, which is security, non-US stuff, web search, www master. They didn't get onto any of the project machines, so they're not worried about packages or any of their software being broken into and somebody putting some malicious backdoor or changing out any of the code. So they said the machines were fairly up-to-date and up-to-date on patches. I had read the whole article. I think they said they were behind on, which patch was it? It was one patch, one or two patches on one or, you know, not all the machines, but one or two of the machines that weren't patched, but they don't believe that that was a method of gaining root access. Basically, they think that it was a SNF password of a non-administration account, like basically just a normal user, and they use that to get access to the machine locally, and then somehow they escalated their privileges to being root. So they don't know exactly how that happened, and they're suggesting that there may be, they're speculating that there may be an unknown vulnerability out there. I'm not surprised. I mean, vulnerabilities are always out there until somebody releases them, and why are they going to release them if they want to use them, you know? It's kind of like a special trading card event, you know? I've got my special limited edition trading card here, you know, my hidden exploit that nobody knows about. It's kind of fun. But, yeah, you know, it's something to think about. But that's some of the news on the Linux front. And one of the other things is that a lot more vendors are using Linux in their systems, but they're not obeying the GPL. And a lot of these people that are using it for systems like DVD players, there's actually a large number of, I think there's about 5 or 6 people here, that use Linux as their operating system, or the correct term, GNU Linux, as their operating system to support their device. Now, what they're doing is they do release like firmware upgrades and stuff like that, but it's only in binary. So you don't actually have the source code, which is a part of obeying the GPL licenses. If you do any modifications, or if you just distribute the code, period, or if you're using it, you have to distribute the source of that code. And that's not what they're doing. They're not distributing the source of their code, and they're not distributing any modifications, if any, to the code, which I'm sure there are. So some people are violating that.
And it's usually that they're reactive as opposed to proactive, because I've been on a lot of sites where they won't make source code available until, like, after everybody's, like, slammed them on their bulletin boards or something.
Yeah, they're like, look, we can just, you know, get this free code, adapt it a little bit. Now we have our whole machine going. We didn't have to buy Windows XP embedded. We didn't have to buy anything else. And there we go. Now, shoot, we don't want anyone to see our features. We don't want anyone to be able to break into it. That's a worry. But you can't just steal the open source code and then not obey the license.
Yeah, but if we don't know how to program and we want to look like we've got a product and, you know, we got to, like, fake it, and, you know.
Yeah, or, you know, it saves them a lot of money so they don't have to develop it themselves or go buy and someone else's. So, well, you know, this is a response going along the lines here. This is a response to when Red Hat had said that Linux isn't ready. GNU Linux isn't ready for the desktop yet. They're saying it's more prone for corporate desktops. And because Linux may not work with every single piece of hardware, digital camera, you know, USB device, it works with a lot. But, you know, and some of the software isn't written. You know, if you get a digital camera, their software is not made for Linux, stuff like that.
They're just mad that they can't get PowerPoint.
Yeah, actually you can, but you can't, you know, there's some limitations, but, you know, their point was that it's not ready, and in some ways it isn't, but in some ways, home users aren't ready for what Linux is.
But then you have what are called niche operating systems. I mean, for instance, for a long, long, long time, you didn't have multitasking on, you know, Macintosh, for instance. But because it was stronger in other areas like WYSIWYG and PostScript, it was the, you know, platform of choice for publishers, but it lacked, you know, the robustness for CAD/CAM. So some didn't have to be for everything to be useful.
Yeah. And we're kind of spawning off a little bit of some thought of our reaction to that what Red Hat said. But, you know, there's a lot of things that Linux does that the home user, we're talking about your typical Microsoft user, doesn't really understand the tools and what it really is about and the things that are there. You know, it's actually a whole other way of thinking. It's not just the design, but I'm saying the types of applications that are available you don't see anywhere else. You're seeing all sorts of different types of applications that are brand new. They serve, you know, interesting purposes, and, you know, they're available on Linux. And, you know, you just may not have your Photoshops and stuff like that, but it doesn't mean, well, there's GIMP, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to have things eventually move over, because people are going to want to have that choice, and it's a viable choice. But basically, the article is talking about how Hewlett-Packard, Dell, Novell, and even Red Hat, you know, are making and selling Linux desktops. So, you know, to me that sounds, well, I already have like a Linux desktop, but the thing that you're going to recognize is that in a world where there was just PC, you know, being the de facto of making Microsoft operating system, you know, PCs that you're grabbing, and there was nobody really selling a Linux desktop. You couldn't go to a major PC manufacturer, except for Dell, they were one of the first, and get these machines. Now it's telling you something, that they're coming out in the market for a reason, because they think that there's a need or a want. There's a market. So,
but I think market people have a world view that's kind of backwards, and that they keep looking for history to repeat itself. They think everything's a beta versus VHS. You know, like an all-or-nothing proposition, that something has to be the number one standard, and there's no room for diversity or niches or specialization, when in reality, that's when technology is its best, is when it's optimized to the appropriate application, because something that's good for everything is good for nothing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, we're going to wrap up the last bit of the show with our SCO news. Usually like to save it for last, because you can tune out if it really gets annoying.
Or flush.
Yeah, or flush. Thank you for cleansing the show.
Wiping it.
Yeah. Okay. Novell now is being threatened by SCO, because they're saying that Novell, back in the days of 1995, signed a non-compete agreement as part of a broader agreement signed between Novell and the Santa Cruz operation, which SCO sold its rights to the Unix System 5 software in 1995. Okay, I'm kind of reading from the article. Basically, it's saying that when they sold the rights for the Unix operating system to SCO, meaning Novell selling it, they actually signed a non-compete agreement. Well, Novell, you say, well, what do they have to do with Unix now since they sold it? Well, they're back. They've actually are in the process of acquiring SUSE, or SUSE. depending on who you ask how it's supposed to be said. So they said that SCO is now waiting for the SUSE acquisition to be completed before it engages any legal action. And once the deal is done, the non-compete can be invoked at that point. So SCO is saying that they are going to go after SUSE.
Scorched earth policy.
Yeah. If they want to get in the game.
It's like they're doing a dragnet. Yeah, like they're just trying to dredge everything they can find.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, we'll be talking about more things that they're doing.
Pushing the frontiers of laws of discovery in legal pursuits.
Yeah, nothing here has been by the book. Everything's been backroom, dirty tactics, and it's funny because nothing's been proven yet, but yet all these things are occurring.
It's like a fishing expedition. It's almost like they're trying to, and I still don't understand how they're getting a judge to entertain this, because
that's what I was wondering. Yeah,
you know, because normally, as a plaintiff, you have to show damages. You have to actually show harm in a specific way. It's not like you have to say, "Oh, the burden is on you to show you're innocent." No, the burden of proof is on the preponderance of evidence in a civil case. So, unlike a criminal case, the burden of proof is on the person accusing.
Yeah, see, that's you described exactly what's happening. SCO had told IBM, "You show us your contributions, or your what you've contributed to GNU Linux, and then we'll tell you what the problem is."
I mean, they're too stupid to figure it out themselves, and they're wanting you to tell them. I mean, what is that?
How can they? You know, it's like possibly incriminating yourself.
Well, that's like me coming up to you and say, "Hey, how many times have you quoted somebody and not attributed it?" You know.
First of all, I may not know. Second of all, why the hell am I going to tell you? Third of all, maybe I'm not doing anything wrong. Get off my back. You know. So.
Because it's like they're wanting people to volunteer something that's questionable as to whether it's a violation in the first place.
You have your issue. If you have your problem, then you present it, and there it is. And if you're going to do something that's based on nothing, or just a loose fit of something, I don't see where your case is. But
if they have damages, then they have to show the specific code that's been appropriated.
And they have it, and they still haven't. So, yeah. And you know what? I couldn't believe this when I read it. But basically, a man who claims that there is Unix copyright violations within the Linux open source organization. Okay. Basically, it's a rumor. It's not set in stone. But SCO may be getting ready to attack BSD. They said, with our limited energies of what other guys... and what our guys are going through, we probably won't file any suits against BSD until sometime in the first half of next year.
They're not that creative about it. I can remember in the early 90s, Microsoft ran an ad where they said, if you're using an unregistered copy of Microsoft Word, we'd like to hear from you. Contact us and we'll send you this free mouse pad. And they were literally...
Are you serious?
They really did this in 1991 or 92. They ran an ad in Macworld magazine soliciting people to get in touch with them. They wanted to hear from you if you were using an unauthorized copy, and people actually responded, and they got them.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, at least they were creative. I mean, it's not as bad as what they were doing a few years ago.
Okay, here's my take on that. You're too stupid to respond to that ad. You deserve it.
Exactly.
Okay, you deserve it.
That's what I'm saying.
But at least get the free mouse pad. If you're going to go down with a free mouse pad.
I mean, at least they win points, for being creative.
Oh, man. That's,
And there's people that stupid.
Oh, man, that's hilarious. That's awesome. But you better get your free mouse pad. I'd be pissed if I went down and didn't get my free mouse pad. It's going to have Bill's face on the mouse pad smiling. Oh, man. Saying, I'm going to buy a new car. Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, this is kind of interesting. There's a few perspectives going on with this next bit of news. A source claiming to be in the know, says that the SCO group is going to sue Google for not paying its GNU Linux taxes. Last week, SCO threatened to make an example of a big-time GNU Linux user that hadn't paid SCO the licensing fees it demanded and taking it to court for copyright infringement. SCO has not disclosed the identity of its mark, and the SCO CEO, Daryl McBride, claimed Tuesday, earlier this November, that its decision on what company to target wasn't yet final. He said SCO and its lawyers were working with a short list of 7 or 8 names. SCO said that they would sue within 90 days. The GNU Linux community thinks SCO's bluffing and won't make its self-imposed February 17 deadline. McBride said he'd like to play that number in Vegas. The idea behind the suit is obviously to make all major GNU Linux users tractable and make them reach for their checkbooks. It's a household name, talking about Google. It's said to have a GNU Linux server farm of some 10,000 of servers worth $7 million to SCO, as long as SCO's current rate licensing fee is maintained. It's talking about Google here, reportedly putting together a positively glorious IPO that is supposedly be worth $15 to $25 billion. Meanwhile, the industry wags are saying that God invented SCO to give people a company to hate more than Microsoft.
And judging from all the SCO hate sites that we perused before the show, I think it's
We'll talk about this in just a second. But here's the thing: if they do go after Google, right? And we obviously think that here at the show, we obviously think that Microsoft is definitely behind the SCO interests, and maybe some other people as well. But if they go after Google, it's like just recently Microsoft tried to acquire Google. Now they said no. You know, we're going to do our own thing. They're gaining two things here. If they go after Google, they're going to obviously harass more GNU Linux users, and they might squeeze some money out of Google. And it'll be competitor, and it'll be a competitor because they buy Linux.
Well, that's the Microsoft philosophy of creativity and innovation is, if you can't innovate, you just basically,
it's like the Borg.
You litigate from all angles. That's a turkey shoot. They're going to just squeeze them from every angle.
Yeah. So it's definitely what's happening. Okay. Well, yeah. You know, just for the show, me and Meme were like, I bet you. Or no, actually, we said we should make a SCO site. Or there should be a SCO site out there that says how much SCO sucks. Well, go to SCOSucks.com, actually.
All the good domains are already used.
Yeah, we went to SCOSucks.com, and you can get up-to-date information on how much SCO sucks. But you can also go to FuckSCO.com, and there's actually a beautiful picture of Beavis and Butthead on there. And Butthead's saying, I am the great corn scolio. And Beavis is saying, I need IP for my bunghole.
Yeah, it is just so right on.
And they're they're wearing business suits and stuff like that. So FuckSCO.com is a great site. And
give me my licensing.
Down, Beavis.
You guys are like gonna get screwed because like Microsoft gives us money and stuff, and we're like we're gonna like take our lawyers and really annoy the hell out of you.
We want cash.
yeah, we want money, money, and money, and more money, and yeah.
Yeah, money rules.
Yeah, money rules. Corn folio.
Hey, dude, you think we can get some nachos with this money?
Yeah. Dude, we can get more nachos than you've seen, and we can also get chicks. Dude, chicks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, chicks. Oh, we're finally going to get late. Oh, yeah. Good for school. We're finally going to get late.
All right. Well, that's my abuse and butthead.
Yeah, we'll do King of the Hill next week.
Yeah, King of the Hill next week. Well, what the hell? You guys out there using Linux, you guys owe us some money for our SCO licensing fees.
Looks like you've logged some time on our server here.
What the hell y'all doing using Linux out there in my shed? All right. Anyways, you can see I'm a big Beavis and Butthead fan. So, yeah, check out those sites. And, know what's going on out there, and don't be confused, and don't buy into any of this propaganda that's trying to take away the image of GNU Linux, but it's not.
Yeah,
it's
fight power.
So, all right, well, that is our show this evening. So I am Slip Mode checking out, and we'll see everybody in 2 weeks. You know, feel free to jump on the forums over at slipnet.org and post any information you'd like about the show, any questions, anything you'd like to have read out in the show. And that's me signing out. And DJ Meme.
It's me, Meme, and the Machine. Fight the info war.
All right. Well, we'll see everybody in 2 weeks.